About 2 years ago, another inmate arrived here. He too claimed to have come searching for Iram Radik. This misinformed soul, in fact, claimed not only that he'd met Radik before, but that he'd actually saved Radik's life years ago on the other side of the galaxy, and that Radik had somehow summoned him here to Coghive 7 to offer him a kind of protection as a way of thanking him. Zero took another bite of the fruit loaf, chewed and swallowed. Never mind the practical inconsistencies of the story. This new inmate insisted that Radik was locked up and hiding in here somewhere. No matter how many times he came to me for answers, insisting that I help him, he refused to accept the fact of the matter.
"Which is?"
Maul asked. Zero paused long enough to finish his bite and blotted his lips before looking back up at Maul with an expression of deeply earnest sincerity. "Iram Radik does not exist. He's a cautionary tale, a myth, a bedtime story that small-time galactic gunrunners tell their kids at night. Don't get too big for your britches, or Iram Radik will come and get you, that sort of thing." Zero finished his snack, tossed the carton aside, and stood up in front of Maul, tilting his head so that he could meet Maul's gaze, even as he maintained a careful distance from him. "Hear me well, Jagannath. The so-called man that you seek is not here."
"What happened to the inmate?"
"I'm sorry?"
"The one who came here claiming to have saved Radik's life,"
Maul asked.
"What happened to him?"
"Oh," Zero said vaguely. "He's still around somewhere." Eventually he gave up looking. Disabused of his delusions, I suppose. "This place has a tendency to do that. You'll discover that for yourself, if you survive that long." Maul said nothing. "Now," the Twi'lek said, "since you've taken the trouble to come searching for me, I feel compelled to ask, is there anything else that you're looking for? Anything real?"
"Yes,"
Maul said. "And what might that be?"
"I need a transmitter device. An undetectable means of long-range communication. Any basic subspace image transmitter would suffice."
"I know you've got the necessary parts here in your cell. You..." For the first time, Zero looked nonplussed. "You've discovered that, have you?"
"I need it as soon as possible,"
Maul told him. "What you're asking for won't come cheaply," Zero said. "You must realize that the components that you saw all had to be smuggled in at great personal..."
"What do you want?"
Maul interrupted. "Well..." The Twi'lek drew in a breath, letting it out slowly. "Since you asked, I do seem to be having some recent difficulty with the gangs. The Bone Kings and the Gravity Massive. They..."
"What else?"
"What else?" Zero blinked up at him, bemused. "I assure you, that's quite enough."
"Get the transmitter ready for me,"
Maul told him.
"You'll have no more trouble with gangs." XIV. Jar of Flies. Strabo hated the laundry facility. When he'd first been shipped to Coghive 7, 18 standard months earlier, laundry had been his work detail. He'd sweated for hours among the giant washers and dryers, toiling alongside malfunctioning droids and inmates through mountains of gore-soaked uniforms and sheets. Assigned to him seemingly at random, the sweat, the stink, and the back-breaking monotony of it had been worse than death. But it hadn't lasted long. Soon enough, he'd risen through the ranks of the Gravity Massive, strangling the former leader and moving effortlessly into his place. And as a result, he hadn't had to come back down here in almost a year. Even so, from the moment he'd led the rest of the Gravity Massive inside, the stinging astringency of the cramped chamber was all too familiar to his nose, like a horrible kind of homecoming. The machines were quiet now, shut down for the night, but the faintly howling silence was somehow even more haunting.
"Don't see the point,"
he growled.
"Coming down here in the middle of the night like this."
He looked over his shoulder at the Gravity Massive member standing behind him.
"You sure this was the message?"
"That's what it said."
The inmate known as Ishmash was an Alvanian, long-snouted and sharp-toothed, and Strabo's second in command.
"Word came straight from Halcon.
Captain of the guards, call us all the way down here for what? Something they can't tell us topside."
Strabo shook his head.
"The whole thing stinks."
His lieutenant didn't answer. The Nelvanian was a data pirate, shipped here to Coghive 7 on charges of information sabotage. He was not a fighter or a killer by nature, but his combination of loyalty and freaky tech skills had made him indispensable to Strabo and the Gravity Massive, or at least as indispensable as one could be in an environment where any two inmates might be called on at any moment to slaughter each other. Now, Strabo knew, was not the time to raise that point. An hour earlier, Ishmash had informed him that he'd received, via custodial droid, a covert message from CO Halcon, the captain of the guards here in Coghive 7, telling them to bring the entire GM crew, 13 in all, down into the laundry facility for some sort of clandestine summit between gang and guard. Strabo had been running the crew long enough to know that he ignored such a summons at his peril. Halcon probably wouldn't detonate the charges in his heart over such a minor act of disobedience, but the guard could make his life miserable in a thousand other ways. Everything from cutting his rations to putting him in full lockdown until he was climbing the walls. So here they were, the Gravity Massive en masse, making their way among the chemical vats and tubes, pumping liters of industrial detergents, solvents, along with the liquid cryogens necessary to cool the superconductor power load running to the massive washers and dryers.
"How long we supposed to wait here anyway?"
Strabo grumbled, casting his gaze alongside the washers and dryers, their gaping 70-centimeter bores standing open and motionless in the gloom.
"Did Halcon even say what he wanted with us?"
"No."
"Not even a clue?"
"He told me to come down."
Ishma shrugged.
"That's all."
"Son of a Varga knows he can't touch us, right?"
Strabo said.
"On account of..."
Suddenly, he stopped talking. He'd just detected the none-too-stealthy tap-tap-tap of steel-toed boots approaching in the half-darkness from the far side of the alcove. There was only one point of entrance to the facility, which meant...
"They're already here waiting for us." "Halcon!"
Strabo bellowed out, his strident voice only slightly dampened by the claustrophobic confines of the room.
"We're here. You want to tell us what's so important this time of night?"
There was a solid whump as the hatchway sealed shut behind them. and by the time he realized what was happening, Strabo had already seen who was in front of them. Not guards. Bone kings. And in front of them, Vass Nailhead himself, his angry, bald scalp bulging toward the gravity massive like a pustulent sore. Under the circumstances, Nailhead appeared as surprised as Strabo felt.
"What the?"
he was saying, striding forward, already close enough that Strabo could count all 16 kings clustered up behind him.
"You!"
"Nailhead!"
Strabo glared back at him, the name twisting from his lips like a curse. In his peripheral vision, he was aware of Ishmash and the rest of the massive troops grimly preparing themselves for battle, pulling out short-handled wire scourges, rope darts, and flying claws from inside their uniforms. These chain weapons, fashioned from scavenged materials, sharpened and honed in secret, were the preferred pain-inflicting tools of the massive, and were always kept close at hand.
"What are you doing here? Looking for a rematch?"
"If that's what you want,"
Nailhead said, and his eyes flicked over Strabo's shoulder to Ishmash.
"Got a message to bring the kings down here," the Nelvanian said. "Halcon sent it to me through a utility droid."
"Us too,"
Nailhead said.
"What?"
Strabo squinted at him.
"That can't..."
The rest of the sentence was lost behind a sibilant whoosh from the tall containment vats along the wall. Both gangs spun around to stare at the source of the sound, and when he recognized what it was, Strabo felt his blood run cold. Thick clouds of freezing cold vapor were pouring out of the tanks, rising around them, sucking the oxygen out of the air.
"Cryogens,"
he thought, his mind flashing back to the warnings he'd received about the liquid nitrogen and helium detergents stored inside the tanks, how any sort of leak or breach would literally suck the oxygen from the lungs of anyone unlucky enough to be trapped inside.
"Exhaust fans in the ceiling. The toggle switch overhead."
It was already too late. Strabo felt his trachea clamp down to a pinhole, choking on what should have been air, but instead torn to the delicate inner lining of his throat like a swarm of wasps. His lungs crumpled like empty leather sacks inside his chest, the strength draining from his body all at once as the floor swung up to hit him in the face like a huge blunt fist. His eyes and nose were on fire, his lungs trembling on the verge of revolt. He could no more climb up to activate the exhaust fans than he could draw in another unobstructed breath. From somewhere in front of him, there came a loose and thready shriek. Strabo hoisted his head up and looked out through tear-soaked eyes. Nailhead and the Bone Kings were crumpling, clutching their chests, hacking and wheezing, falling to the floor in piles among members of the gravity massive. In less than 30 seconds, the cryo leak had accomplished what no measure of diplomacy ever could, uniting both gangs in a desperate fraternity of oxygen debt. Strabo saw his own people collapsing next to the kings, side by side, brought low in their final moments, as indistinguishable as flies in a killing jar.
"By the moons of Renok, we're all going to die here,"
he thought wildly. A thumping primordial self-defense mechanism kicked in, more powerful than anything on the conscious level, superseding all other instincts.
"Get out! Get out! Get out! Now!"
Stumbling backward, elbowing his way violently through the ranks of his own people, Strabo groped his way in the direction of the exit, only to find it sealed. Something rammed his arm, and he realized there was someone next to him, a large, frantic shape. It was Nailhead. The bearded man had fought his way over, too, and was jerking even more desperately on the manual release lever, pounding on it, trying to get out. His once-imposing face was a hairy, sweat-slick moon of terror. From just above the hatchway, Strabo felt something take hold of his arm. He looked up. The Zabrak, the one called Jagannath, was glaring down at both of them, his nose and mouth protected by some kind of jury-rigged respirator. Strabo just stared at him, uncertain if what he saw was real or a side effect of the cryogens. He didn't have more than a moment to ponder the possibilities before the Zabrak tossed him aside, striding among the center of the alcove to where the open cryogen vats were spraying out great gunmetal-colored clouds more intensely than ever.
"Switch them off!"
Strabo wanted to shout, though at this point his voice was a pale memory.
"You've got to!"
But Jagannath was already in motion. Using the rungs embedded directly in the wall, he drew himself up and climbed effortlessly to the top of the tank, reached across, and closed two sets of valves. He toggled another switch, and Strabo watched in wonder as the blades of the overhead fans began swinging to life, sucking the cryogens out, venting fresh oxygen into the sealed room. After a moment, the air began to clear. The fans spun on. Strabo watched them swirling round and round as slowly, terribly slowly, the burning knots inside his own lungs began to loosen and disappear. The Zabrak switched off the fans again. Silence fell.
"Hear me."
Strabo wiped his eyes, coughed and spat, and finally looked up. Around him, on either side, kings and massive members alike were gaping up at the Zabrak, with identical expressions of desperate, half-conscious wonder.
"What the cuck do you want?"
Nailhead managed, but his voice was just a raspy, hollowed-out ghost of its former self. Jagannath ignored him.
"What happened here, this cryo leak, was no accident. The captain of the guards, Halcon, did this. I overheard him planning it. That's why he called you all down here."
Nobody said anything. It might have been the suddenness of what had just transpired, but neither gang raised the first murmur of dissent.
"He wants to wipe out the gangs,"
the Zabrak said.
"All of you. You've become more trouble than you're worth. Warden Blur wouldn't have let him get away with it all at once. Some of you still have upcoming matches to fulfill. So Halcon was going to make it look like an accident."
Silence.
"I didn't have to save you,"
Jagannath told them.
"I could just as easily have let you die down here. And every one of you."
His yellow eyes moved across both gangs, taking in their blotchy pale faces.
"You all saw how your so-called leaders behaved just now, turning their backs on you to save themselves, clawing like dogs at the door to get out. They couldn't have cared less."
A collective snarl came out of the crowd. Strabo flung up his hands in an instinctive posture of self-defense. Members of the Gravity Massive and Bone Kings turned to glare at him and Nailhead, the pain and panic in their eyes already changing from accusatory suspicion to outrage rage.
"He's right!"
someone shouted.
"I saw it too!"
"They led us here."
"It was them!"
"Hold it!"
Strabo took a step back and bumped into Nailhead, who already had his back to the wall. The other inmates jammed in toward them, even closer. Izmash's lips had drawn back in a snarl to reveal sharpened canines and incisors. Strabo felt a half-dozen hands coming from a half-dozen different directions, groping to take hold of him, ready to rip him apart.
The time of gangs is coming to an end here,
Jagannath's voice said from up above.
Halcon won't rest until he's destroyed you all.
He can't do that!
Strabo swung at the gang members, kings and gravity massive alike.
We are protected because of what we do, the way we serve Radik.
His voice broke off. All the inmates who had been about to attack him just a split second earlier took a step back, creating an open space around him, as if they'd just found out Strabo was infected with some horrifically contagious disease. Even Nailhead moved away from him. Jagannath stared down at him.
What about Radik?
Strabo lowered his head.
How do the gangs work for him? What do they do?
Strabo looked at Ishmash, but the Nalvanian refused to meet his gaze.
None of them would.
It was over for him. Strabo realized that he'd gone from their leader to a complete outcast in the time it took to mention that single name.
Tell me,
Jagannath said, casting one more glance across the two gangs before directing his gaze back at Strabo. The unspoken message was clear enough.
Your reign here is over. Only I can protect you now.
Strabo opened his mouth and snapped it shut again. When he finally managed to summon his voice, the words came out involuntarily, as if jerked from his lips by an invisible hook.
The parts, he said. The weapons components.
What about them?
They come smuggled in on the supply ships. We each get one piece, small enough to tuck into our uniform and hide in our cell. Nobody knows what anybody else gets. Nobody knows how they fit together. Nobody knows where they go and how they get there.
How does Radik get them from you?
No one knows. They just disappear.
Jagannath glared at him.
Disappear.
It's all I know,
Strabo said.
And he pays us the same way, with the quipus.
He pulled up his pant leg to reveal the string of knots tied around his ankle.
They're coded to a hidden account, a form of payment that the guards can't access.
The Zabrak turned to survey the rest of the room.
I know that you all work for Radik in some capacity, which means that you already serve a common purpose. Now, you'll all serve one leader.
He straightened up.
Me.
Never!
Off to his left, Strabo saw Nailhead lunge forward with his fists clenched, eyes blazing, and realized that he himself had also stepped up to confront this indignity head-on, as some animal part of him refused to bow before the newly appointed leader. The Zabrak reacted faster than either he or Nailhead could. Seizing Nailhead from behind, the one called Jagannath hooked his fingers into the flesh-eater's nostrils and yanked his head straight back to expose his throat before driving his fist into the cartilage of Nailhead's windpipe, dropping him to the floor in a wheezing, debilitated heap. Strabo saw the Zabrak pivot, shooting his foot straight up so that it hit Strabo in the solar plexus, leaving him doubled over and sucking air. Darkness was closing in. Strabo fought to shake it off. Jagannath's voice seemed to be coming from very far away, but there was a cold ferocity to it that would not be ignored.
You work for me now,
the Zabrak said.
You can each maintain your loyalty to your crews. But as of now, I'm putting myself in charge at the top. I will mediate between you and the guards.
He turned to Nailhead, staring straight into the Flesh Eater's eyes.
Also, from this point on, there will be no more harassment of the inmate known as Zero. Is that understood? That goes for both gangs.
Nobody said anything. Strabo stared at his feet. For the moment, at least, he couldn't bring himself to look at the other members of the gang he used to run. When he looked up again, the Zabrak was gone.
XV. Limerge.
Rise up, my apprentice.
At the sound of that voice, Maul's pulse quickened. He rose to his feet and stared at the holographic image of his master. The one called Zero had been as good as his word. Less than 2 hours after Maul had dealt with the gangs, he'd received a coded message to come here to a remote corner of the prison morgue, to one of the empty chambers designed to hold inmates' corpses for disposal. It had been waiting here for him. The transmitter, fully assembled and functional. And now, the image of Sidious stood before him, the Sith Lord's yellow eyes blazing deep within the cowl of his cloak. His Zayd cloth robe swept around him, the coarse fabric rustling audibly as Sidious raised his hand. In the background, small details of the top of Limerge Tower's interior were clearly visible, and Maul was momentarily taken aback by the vivid resolution of the image. Scavenged or not, Zero's technology was of impressively high quality.
"Master,"
he said aloud, or tried to, but the word stuck in his throat.
"You look well, my apprentice. I have been monitoring your progress among the inhabitants of Coghive 7 with great interest."
"Yes, Master."
"I observe that regardless of the circumstances, throughout these bouts with other inmates, you have taken great care not to reveal your true powers as a Sith."
Was there a twinge of sarcasm in his voice?
"That much is quite abundantly evident."
"You are referring to the most recent bout."
Maul hesitated.
"The Wampa
proved to be something of a challenge, yes, so I saw. Perhaps you found yourself wishing that you might be permitted to draw unreservedly on the power of the dark side, or to be allowed the use of your saber staff."
Sensing a trap, Maul demurred.
"My strength comes from within."
"Does it indeed?"
Sidious gave him a long, unreadable look.
"I wonder."
"Master,
pride and self-regard are not accolades to be earned only once. The power of the Sith must prove itself stronger with every test. Resting on your accomplishments now will only inhibit your ability to fully exploit the resources of anger and discipline that lie within you."
"Yes, Master."
"Protecting your identity and the true purpose of your mission will be meaningless if you die before you achieve it."
Sidious paused, gazing at him piercingly.
"Do my words sting? Perhaps you find my assessment unfair."
"No."
The Sith Lord drew back.
"I expect much from you, Darth Maul. Only because I alone grasp your true potential for greatness in the dark side. Thank you, Master.
My only wish.
Enough!
Sidious's face went abruptly cold.
Your restraint, training, and discipline will only take you so far. What progress have you made in locating Iram Radik?
I have intensified my search. I brought the prison gangs to heel, and have made inroads in discovering the methods of their service to Radik.
Maul met his master's gaze.
It will not be long now.
He paused, then pressed on. Perhaps if you are able to confide in me the true purpose of our plans. Sidious raised one hand, cutting the words off.
You have been provided with all the information you require to complete your mission. For now, all you need to know is that we are continuing with our work to destabilize the Outer Rim, fueling insurgency and separatism.
The Sith Lord drew in a breath and released it, holding Maul's gaze with what might have been sympathy.
Your reputation of loyalty to our cause is firmly established. I am not oblivious to the fact that you have been disappointed by your role in our plans up till now, that you may have craved a more pivotal role in the Eriadu operation, for example.
Maul tried to suppress his sense of surprise, and failed. How had Sidious known of that? After his master had used security droids to covertly orchestrate the assassination of 6 directorate members at the Eriadu Trade Summit and attempted to kill Chancellor Valorum, Maul had been unable to understand why Sidious hadn't involved him personally in the operation. He assumed that he'd hidden his disappointment well, buried it deep inside him, where even he had been able to overlook it. Yet his master had seen through him.
Suffice it to say that what you are achieving now with Iram Radik will far surpass any smaller errand that I could have given you.
Yes, Master.
Good then. Rise and go forth. Take what is rightfully ours. The dark side is with you.
Maul tried to respond, but the vision in front of him, of his master and the debris-cluttered floor of the Limerge building, was already starting to fade. Stepping away from the Holovid unit, Darth Sidious opened his eyes and crossed the floor of the Limerge tower to the turbolift, his mind already teeming with a collision of thoughts. As with any mission involving Maul, the situation that Sidious was creating on Coghive 7 was not entirely stable. The Sith Lord harbored no delusions about his apprentice's ambition or pride, or how closely those elements were linked to the anger that was constantly sweltering inside his apprentice, fermenting as Maul's power continued to intensify. Locked in unswerving allegiance to their cause, the Zabrak's heart was a reactor of pure, distilled rage.
And that rage will serve him well.
Yes. When Sidious reflected back on the years of training that Maul had endured, proving himself repeatedly against the worst that the galaxy had to offer, he felt an unmistakable pride in his apprentice's strength and fortitude. By definition, Coghive 7 was an environment that no one survived. Yet Maul had already established himself as a dominant presence without relying on the Force. Despite what he'd said to Maul, Sidious felt an increasing respect for what his apprentice continued to achieve. In the fullness of time, such abilities would continue to serve him better than he could possibly imagine. By the time he left the building and walked out to hail a sky cab to the Senate District, the Sith Lord's concerns had abated. The hour was yet early, and his schedule for the day, as Palpatine, was already full. The air taxi darted down toward him, whirring to a halt, and as the door opened, he realized with a start that the cab wasn't empty. Hugo Damask was waiting for him inside. "Darth Sidious," Damask said, gesturing to the empty seat beside him. "Will you join me?" Palpatine flicked his eyes toward the air taxi's cockpit, but Damask gave him a reassuring nod.
"I've rendered the surveillance equipment inoperative," the moon said, "so that we may speak freely. As equals."
"Of course." Without hesitating, Darth Sidious slipped inside next to the moon, his expression revealing just the right tincture of pleasant surprise. "It's always good to see you under any circumstances."
"Yes."
Behind the transpirator mask, Darth Plagueis offered what might have been a faint smile.
"I know we had plans to meet later in Monument Plaza for our usual stroll, but something's come up and I had to alter my schedule at the last minute. I thought it best that we meet now."
He turned to Sidious and cast a passing glance back at the Limerge building.
"I take it that you've been in touch with the Zabrak."
"As a matter of fact, I just..."
"I recall you mentioning that you've dispatched him to Coghive 7 to find this elusive weapons dealer."
"Iram Radik, yes."
Sidious was careful to sound as casual as possible, although inside he was already puzzled. Darth Plagueis knew only the broadest generalities about Darth Sidious's ongoing work to destabilize the Outer Rim planets and orchestrate the Galactic Civil War. He rarely asked specific questions about where the weapons were coming from, or how exactly Sidious intended to use them to facilitate the grand plan.
"This Radik..."
Plagueis continued in the same conversational tone as he gazed out the window at the approaching avenue of the Core Founders.
"Is rumored to be one of the most powerful arms dealers in the galaxy."
"Radik is as dangerous as he is unpredictable."
Sidious was aware of an unwelcome warmth beginning to climb upward through the back of his neck, enveloping his cheeks and forehead.
"Which is why I sent Maul to assassinate him."
"I see."
Sidious leaned slightly forward in an attempt to catch Plagueis' eye.
"I've been meaning to inform you. My mission there..."
"Is something I have absolute confidence in your ability to execute."
Plagueis placed a hand on Sidious' shoulder.
"I must commend you on your foresight and commitment to our ultimate purpose, Darth Sidious. As you might have guessed, with the increasing demands of my own private pursuits on sojourn, I find it profoundly liberating that I do not need to monitor the particular means with which you uphold our united goal."
"Yes, of course."
Sidious regarded him speculatively. What exactly was Plagueis telling him? Did the moon harbor his own dark suspicions about what Sidious had hoped to achieve in sending Maul to Coghive 7? Or was Plagueis simply probing him for more detail?
"Well..."
Plagueis had already settled back again with a nearly inaudible sigh.
"I suppose this is goodbye for now."
The air taxi docked, and Sidious realized that he'd arrived at the Senate Rotunda. The cab's hatch released with a faint sigh, and as he began to step out, he felt Plagueis' hand take hold of his wrist.
"There is one other thing," he said, with that same tone of cordial detachment. "I thought you should know that all your talk of Coghive 7 piqued my interest."
"Indeed."
Sidious felt something tighten inside his throat.
"How so?"
"I've spoken to a contact at the IBC and asked them to dispatch a financial consultant there under the auspices of a routine quarterly audit, a certain Vesto Slipher. He'll be reporting directly to me."
Behind the mask, Plagueis' smile was pure diplomatic graciousness.
Perhaps I can help you ferret out this elusive arms dealer after all.
Sidious felt a faint knot tightening in his throat.
That's extremely thoughtful of you.
I know we are together on this,
Plagueis said.
As equals.
Plagueis withdrew his hand. He was still gazing out at Sidious when the air taxi's hatch closed between them, and it lifted away from the Senate Plaza, leaving Sidious standing there alone.
Nightside.
The debris pile was made up of burned-out droid parts, condenser coils, and twisted rebar, all of it forcibly compressed into a perfect cube. Artigan had scavenged together a dozen such blocks down here a year ago, while wandering through an unfinished wing off Maintenance Sublevel 3, the one that the inmates called Nightside. Originally designated as Coghive 7's garbage dump, Nightside was now a desolate industrial cave, its shadows bulking with unused scrap balers, shearing machines, and metal shredders. The stink of carbon composite and various ferroalloys hung permanently in the air. Prisoners came down here from time to time, scrounging through leftover debris, ever since the rumor began circulating that somebody once found a Baragwin shield disruptor in a pile of heavy smelting scrap. The story was probably apocryphal, but it drew them anyway. None of which explained why Artigan Truax had brought his son here today.
Very good.
Artigan glanced at the block of debris and then turned back to Egan.
This one now.
That?
The boy gave it a sidelong glance.
It's too much! My arms are already burned out from those deadlifts.
Excuses won't save you.
Artigan gazed at his son sternly.
Do you wish to survive this place or not?
Egan nodded and shut his eyes. He was stripped to the waist, his bare torso pale and nearly hairless. He'd spent the last few hours chasing prison rats across elevated girders, attacking them with both hands tied behind his back. They were large, disgusting things, but they moved fast, and pursuing them required absolute focus and determination. Afterward, he'd practiced punching, kicking, swinging, ducking, lifting, pulling. Artigan coaching his son through the various holds, locks, and attacks that might one day make all the difference in a bout. There were no rules here in Coghive 7, no such things as mercy, no quarter asked or given. After the morning workout, sweat gleamed from Egan's upper lip and forehead, plastering the reddish-brown hair against his brow in strands and clumps.
Now?
Whenever you're ready.
Reclining backward, Egan tilted his head back and reached for the makeshift crossbar that his father had jimmied up beneath the pallet. Artigan waited while his son tested the bar to make sure the load was balanced, and he watched his son's features tense up in anticipation of the lift.
Get under it,
Artigan said.
How many?
Start with one.
The boy shut his eyes and pushed. Muscles leapt out across his shoulders, chest, and abdomen, biceps straining, arms extending until he held the debris pile at arm's length off the floor. He started to lower it, but Artigan spoke.
Hold it on my count.
Egan didn't argue. The load trembled. The boy's jaw clenched, fighting gravity and fatigue every passing second. Throughout it all, Artigan stood over him without expression, watching the weakness drained from his son's body, feeling the familiar mingling of deep pride and dismay that came with the realization of how hard the boy was working, and ultimately, how little it mattered. Egan grunted.
Father!
5 more seconds, Artigan said. You can do it.
The boy tucked his chin. By now his face had gone a dark, plummy shade of scarlet, all the way up to his hairline. Veins stood out in his temples. A slight, involuntary whimper escaped his throat.
and Artigan heard the load beginning to rattle as the boy's arms trembled harder than ever, threatening collapse.
I can't!
2 more seconds, Artigan told him. 1? He nodded. That's enough. The load dropped with a crash, and Egan let out a gasp of relief. Sitting up slowly, rubbing his shoulders and trembling with the lactic acid buildup in his muscles, Artigan tossed in the towel and waited while the boy mopped his face and glanced back at the cube before finally lifting his gaze to look up at Artigan. His face was pale now, drained but clearly pleased.
How much?
Egan asked. 120.
I've never lifted that much before.
You asked for a true test, Artigan said. I gave you one. Reaching down to ruffle his son's sweaty hair, he felt a tenderness that he rarely allowed himself to acknowledge. The deep love whose only counterweight was the deep knowledge that all too soon it would be taken away. He withdrew his hand. Now, he said, the 52 fists. Egan's eyes widened.
Father!
Now. Reluctantly, the boy assumed the position of readiness, neck straight, body rigid, arms upraised, a veil of doomed hopelessness already descending over his face. Comprising a blizzard of lightning-fast attacks over a period of less than 5 seconds, the attack known as 52 fists required total commitment to absolute destruction of the opponent. Done properly, it could kill a man 3 times Egan's size and weight. But the slightest tremor of intent left its unlucky practitioner wide open to all manner of retribution. Now, Artigan said. The boy launched himself at his father, arms scissoring in a blur of punches. At first, the results appeared promising. But all too quickly, Artigan saw a hole, lunged forward, and threw his son to the floor. Egan lay supine, gasping for air, eyes shining, cheeks and forehead blazing. Only now did the anger come, belated, impotent.
Are you going to cry then?
Artigan didn't bother hiding the disappointment on his face.
You know the rule?
Yes, father.
The boy jerked his head up and down fiercely, fighting back tears. From the beginning, the rule had been simple. For every tear, a drop of blood.
Then get up, Artigan said, extending his hand. And we'll try again.
Yes, father.
And all for what?
A new voice jeered from the far end of the shop, ringing off the flat metal surfaces that surrounded them.
1 match, 2 if he's lucky.
Father and son turned to look at the guard stepping out from behind a massive briquette press hunkered in the far corner. Making his way toward them, C.O. Voistock approached the debris block and gave it an appreciative kick before turning his full attention to Artigan and Egan.
You're wasting your time, kid,
the guard said wryly.
You know that, right?
I'm training.
For what? A one-way trip down the cremation shaft?
That's...
Egan's face contorted, becoming bitter.
What would you know about strength and discipline?
Strength and discipline, huh?
Still grinning, Voistock tucked his thumbs into his belt and rocked back on his heels.
I like that. Remind me to have it engraved on your dad's corpse as an inspiration to others.
My father could tear a man like you to pieces without breaking a sweat.
A little bit of the guard's smile faded.
Forget it, Junior. I don't fight the elderly.
He held the Blasco title for 3 straight seasons. Did you know that?
Egan took a step toward him.
Without that switch on your hip, you wouldn't last 5 seconds against him.
Don't push it, boy. Remember who you're talking to.
I'm almost ready. Tell him, father.
Right.
Voistock laughed, but there was no humor in it. Only the brittle exasperation of a man whose patience was being sorely tried.
Kid, you wouldn't last 5 seconds in a fight. Even your old man knows it.
Reaching up, he ran one hand over his stubble jawline.
Why do you think he's paying me to help you two bottom feeders bust out of here?
What are you talking about?
You don't believe me? Ask your dad. What do you think I'm doing down here? Breathing in all this metal dust for my health?
The boy fell silent. His eyes shifted from Voistock to his father. And then he said in a very quiet voice,
Is it true?
Egan,
is it true?
Son,
Artigan said,
We'll both die here if we... You said I was strong enough! You said that I was ready to fight!
Artigan closed his eyes. This was going to be harder than he'd expected, he realized, and infinitely more painful. He drew his hands out of his pockets so that Egan could see how badly they trembled.
Son, it's over for us here. Don't say that. It's not true. You're already stronger and faster than I am.
Artigan continued.
But you're not a killer.
He steadied his hand and placed it on the boy's bare shoulder. Felt the tension that had gathered there, twisted into knots of post-adolescent indignation.
There's deep steel in you, yes, but there's also great mercy, kindness.
He drew in a deep, resigned breath.
This is no place for a boy like you.
Boy. That single word seemed to lie more crushingly upon Egan than any of the weights he'd had to lift.
Then why did you bring me here?
He asked. Artigan looked away. It was the one question he couldn't answer.
It was a mistake. A mistake! I miscalculated. Relied on salvation from a man who could not provide it.
He moved past his son, shifting toward Voistock.
Can you get us into medbay?
Voistock gazed at him for a long moment.
When?
Right now.
What's the rush?
I would prefer not to linger here any longer than we absolutely have to.
Artigan realized that he was clenching his fists and forced himself to open them. His fingernails had cut tiny red half moons into the lines of his palms.
Yes or no?
The guard sighed and nodded.
Yeah,
he said, and checked the chrono strapped to his wrist.
I can't disrupt the primary and auxiliary feed to the medbay. When the power doesn't come back on the grid, maintenance will have to run a black start. It will take 15 minutes to bootstrap the main server arrays back online.
But if you disrupt all the power,
then how... Voistock held up one hand to stop him.
At that point, our standard protocol is to reroute all power through the GH7, so they can patch surveillance through the droid's photoreceptors. That's when you'll make your move.
All right.
You realize they'll see your faces. You'll have to do something about that.
It's not a problem,
Artigan said.
You've got 15 minutes. If the droid hasn't deactivated the electrostatic charges in your hearts by then, there's nothing else I can do.
I understand.
I mean it.
Voistock locked eyes with him.
You're on your own. We're not friends. Which means you and your boy are a couple of hard targets just like any other runaway. I don't know how you're going to get out of medbay, and I don't care. Anybody asks me if I've seen you, I tell them everything.
Then let's go. Father, no!
Egan wheeled around, and now all his renewed anger and disbelief were focused where Artigan had been expecting it all along. Directly on him.
He's setting us up! Can't you see that? He's just going to steal every credit you have, drain the accounts, and send us right back into the cells again! He'll betray us the first chance he gets!
Egan, he's our one hope of getting out. And we have to go now.
I can learn the 52 fists. I just need more time.
Artigan took hold of his son, clasping him in a sweaty embrace. The boy squirmed, pushing back, fighting to resist. He was stronger than Artigan now. And under any other circumstances, he would have broken the hold, but his arms were tired, the muscles spent from lifting. At last, he collapsed into Artigan's arms, glaring up at his father in impotent fury.
"That's why you worked me so hard," he said tonelessly. "So I couldn't stop you."
"Stop us,"
Artigan corrected, and flicked his gaze at Voistock, narrowing his eyes.
"Are you ready?"
Voistock nodded.
"Just waiting on you. Let's go."
XVII. Ghost Voltage.
An hour after he'd stashed the transmitter and left the prison morgue, Maul was circulating silently among Coghive 7's genpop. He'd dispatched another message through a maintenance droid, the same one he'd used to summon the gangs down to the prison laundry, and was waiting to hear back from the inmate he'd contacted. In the meantime, he stood and watched the crowds of prisoners moving about their business. There was, as always, a kind of heightened sensitivity that came whenever he'd spent any significant time with his master. An increased awareness of things, both hidden and exposed. The crackling prescience of latent energy fields that he'd come to think of as ghost voltage. Even here, among the dregs of the galaxy, Maul found it revelatory and exhilarating. He was crossing the gallery outside the mess hall when he spotted the inmate called Izsmash through a crowd of inmates. The Nelvanian's expression did not change, but the recognition in his eyes told Maul that he'd received the message Maul had sent earlier. Without a word, Maul pivoted, heading down the corrugated durasteel ramp through the narrow passageway that led into the maintenance tunnels below. Bare electrical fixtures threw their flat, declamatory glare across the floor beneath his feet, outlining his silhouette as crisply as a shape cut from the blackness of the universe itself. 20 meters down, he stopped and ducked deeper into the shadows, listening for approaching footfalls. After a moment, Izsmash spoke, his voice hushed.
"I came alone," he said. "What do you want?"
Maul turned and stepped into view.
"Information. You can threaten me all you want. I won't talk about Rud."
Catching himself, he stopped.
"I won't talk about that individual. That's not why I asked you here,"
Maul said.
"In any case, I doubt you know anything about Iram Radik that I haven't already found out."
Izsmash frowned.
"Then why? Strabo told me why you were sentenced to this place,"
Maul said.
"You're a renegade programmer. A data thief. Word is that you wrote the original cryptoviral code for that attack on the Phage network." "That's never been..."
Maul held up his hand.
"I need you to hack into the prison database. Get me information about all the inmates and their criminal history. I need a complete list. It's going to take time. I know something about slicing into systems myself."
Maul said, his mind cycling back to what felt like a lifetime ago, when the one known as Trezza had taught him computer saboteur skills during part of his time on Orsis.
But right now, I don't want the exposure. Let me know when it's finished.
The Nelvanian cocked his head.
Anything else? I'll let you know.
Izsmash nodded and turned to go, and all at once the lights above them flickered and dimmed. Maul glanced at him, immediately aware of the inmate's reaction.
What was that?
He asked.
Some kind of brownout. Felt like a power outage.
It's uncommon here.
Very.
Izsmash shook his head.
There's too many backups and auxiliary relays. The last time it happened...
He glanced over his shoulder, then back at Maul.
It was an escape attempt.
What happened?
It was about a year ago. A couple of the cons got wise and tried to override the prison's main power grid from the medbay and reprogram the surgical droid to disarm the charges so they could get out.
Did it work? Izsmash shook his head.
They died in the medbay.
The guards caught them?
It wasn't the guards.
Who then?
Izsmash licked his lips. His eyes fell to the floor, then rose to meet Maul's, and his voice was just the ghost of a whisper.
Radik.
Why?
He never lets anyone leave.
Any inmate who's ever worked for him in any capacity, who might know anything about him, who might be able to provide his enemies with the slightest hint of his whereabouts. That's why he's based his operation in a prison where nobody survives. If they tried to escape...
Maul felt something quicken within him. In some deeply intuitive way that defied all logical explanation, he already knew that he'd found what he was looking for. The next step toward his mission here. Whether this was the dark side at work, as Sidious had promised, or something as random as pure chance, it scarcely mattered. Before Izsmash had finished speaking, Maul was already moving back up the ramp and across the gallery toward what awaited him on the far side of the prison's main level. Toward Medbay. Black Start.
Warden, Dragomir Chloris said, you still don't seem to understand the gravity of your situation.
Really? Siddiqui Blur sank back with a silent groan, rotating her fingertips against her throbbing temples, where the first vestiges of a killer migraine were slowly making themselves known. This conversation with the gaming commissioner had been one of the longest in recent memory, and there was still no end in sight. Then you'd better run through it again. After all, I've already got an IBC representative on site auditing my whole operation. But I suppose I'm just too dense to figure out what that means. Chloris sighed.
It's not the IBC that you need to worry about. The Desilogic clan has taken an interest in your operation, and it's been going on for quite some time.
The Huts? Siddiqui gave a weary laugh. I expect I would notice if I had a problem with them, don't you think? Chloris's face remained grim.
Well, they've certainly noticed you. And they haven't taken fondly to the way that Coghive 7 has eaten away at their revenues.
That's preposterous. Their gambling operations are more lucrative than ever.
I'm not just speaking of gambling, Siddiqui.
She peered up at him wearily. What else do you think we do around here? Moisture farming?
You understand this is strictly off the record.
The commissioner leaned in closer, lowering his voice.
I'm sure you've heard the rumors about Iram Radik, the weapons dealer said to run his operation from somewhere within Coghive 7.
Oh, no. Siddiqui's migraine jumped from nascent to fully formed in one breathtaking instant. Not that old wheeze again.
Yes, you've told me Radik isn't in your prison, if he even exists at all. But the Huts aren't so sure. In fact, they've apparently decided to see for themselves.
What do you mean, see for themselves?
I simply mean that...
The signal froze. In the background, Siddiqui heard a steady, low-frequency tone begin to pulse as a panel of red and yellow alarm lights sprang up along the top of the console. She straightened. Look, Dragomir, I've got a situation here. I have to go. We'll talk again.
Siddiqui, wait!
Cutting the call short, she jumped on the comm and tapped into central control for the prison's main power station. Control, do you copy? This is Warden Blur. I need a status report for Section 1212.
Copy that, Warden.
The guard's voice drawled back with a maddening lack of concern.
Looks like a minor malfunction down in Medbay.
Siddiqui hit the acknowledge button on the warning alarms, silencing them. Minor malfunction? From my side, it looks like the whole level's gone down.
Stand by for confirmation.
The readout along the comlink's display identified him as C.O. Madden.
Yeah, roger that, Warden. Looks like it's just a transient fault. Where are we setting it now?
Siddiqui brought up the surveillance screens for the medbay, but the monitors were solid blue across every frequency. Where's my backup power?
Must have gone down with the primary.
So you're telling me we've got nothing in there right now?
Affirmative. That's...
Now Madden actually sounded a little nervous, which Siddiqui would have found gratifying if he hadn't been expected to perform competently under these circumstances.
No worries. We're patching all surveillance through to the GH-7 surgical droid on site. Should have audio-visual backup in just a second.
Who's in medbay now?
Stand by.
There was the chirp of an electronic tablet being nudged to life.
No organic life forms. Currently, it looks like it's just the GH-7. And...
A pause.
Hold it.
What is it?
Thermal sensors are picking something up.
Who is it? Siddiqui felt her migraine spilling over, sending sharp pains down the back of her neck.
Might just be a faulty reading. Stand by.
His voice cut out. With a grimace, Siddiqui turned and tapped in a series of commands, bringing up a current list of admissions to the prison's medbay. According to the current census, it should have been empty in there. She hit the comm again, harder than she intended. Madden, do you copy? A blast of static, and then Madden came back, sounding faint.
Copy.
Where's my surveillance?
Still recalibrating off the main grid.
There was a hurried clicking noise of many different switches being thrown to no effect, and the guard muttered something that she couldn't hear.
External network's not coming back up for some reason. We're going to have to do a black start. Bootstrap it back up. It'll take 15 minutes. Then we should be good.
What about those other life forms in medbay? How many are there?
I've got a squad heading down there now. That must be what we're seeing. I'll let you know the second we're back up.
Siddiqui sat back and forced herself to be patient. Waiting around for information wasn't exactly her specialty. And in the past, working in casinos and managing large-scale off-world resort operations, her inability to suffer fools had served her well. But all too often, when power fell off the grid in Coghive 7, there was nothing to do but wait. The truth was, she was as much to blame as anyone. Even before the sheer mathematical elegance of the algorithm had brought it to life, her brother's original designs for Coghive 7 had been beautiful. A seamless installation of utilitarian art. Redundant power backups and secondary electrical relays were all supposed to have been installed as part of Coghive 7 initial construction, along with the metal shop, the factory floor, and a half dozen other independently sealed sublevels. But there had been construction delays, bureaucratic wheels to be greased, permits to be secured, and impatient investors demanding to see quarterly profit and loss statements. And in the end, they'd cut a few corners. A lot of them, actually. As much as Siddiqui couldn't tolerate weak-minded excuses among underlings, she loathed them more vociferously in herself. The truth behind what had really happened here came down to far more than just a few loose ends. The truth was that when Dakarai's algorithm had started paying out and the money had come pouring in, she'd more or less completely abandoned any further construction inside the prison. Given a choice, she knew that the IBC would have extended her time and credits enough to finish the space station properly according to the original specs. But it was Siddiqui herself who had pushed it prematurely into its fully operational status, knowing full well that Coghive 7's wiring, surveillance feeds, and power grids were substandard, and, in some cases, virtually non-existent. And it was Siddiqui who had allowed herself to become overconfident about the implanted cardiac electrostatic charges inside the inmates' hearts, telling herself that as preventative measures went, it was more than enough of a deterrent. But there had been other compensations, some of them very lucrative indeed.
Warden?
Madden's voice came back through. I'm here.
We've got visual in the medbay coming on now. It's all low light through the GH7's photoreceptors, but—
Just patch me through, Siddiqui snapped, and turned to the screens in front of her. There was a sharp hiss, and a turgid upswell of white noise droned across the monitors. As it cleared, she found herself looking down through the surgical droid's floating perspective, drifting into the medbay, its walls and ceiling a green-tinted field of indistinct image-intensified blobs. Unfamiliar voices crackled through the droid's auditory sensor.
Father,
one of the voices was saying.
You know we can't trust him. Why would you? He's the only one who can help us.
The man's voice cut in.
We need him. But what if it's a trap?
Better listen to your old man, kid.
A third voice growled.
I'm the only chance you've got.
Siddiqui sat bolt upright in her seat. She recognized that voice. Voistock. She slapped the comm again, actually cracking the stud with the palm of her hand. Madden, there's a guard in there!
Copy that, Warden. We just...
He's helping them escape, you idiot! Where are your people?
Say again?
The officers on duty, Madden. Where are your men?
I don't...
Madden's voice blipped out, then came back again.
Whoever's in the medbay has it sealed down from inside.
Now he sounded like he was trying very hard not to start stuttering. But he wasn't doing a very good job.
I don't know how it happened. We were just...
Get in there now!
You want us to blast it open?
Whatever it takes.
But...
Siddiqui cut him off and turned back to the screens, her headache utterly forgotten, superseded now by the pounding of her heart and the realization that she'd actually broken a sweat. Time itself seemed to have crystallized around her. On screen, through the droid's photoreceptors, she could make out the forms of two inmates, an older man and a boy not more than 16, both clearly visible as they leaned in. CO Voistock stood in the background, making an adjustment to one of the control modules. The GH7's manipulator was extending something, it looked like a hypodermic needle, toward the boy's chest. In the distance, she could hear the voices of guards outside the medbay, shouting commands and trying to get through the blast doors. And implacably, above it all, the mocking voice of the IBC's finest, Vesto Slipher, echoing in her head.
You've never had an escape?
Of all the times for the IVC to be conducting an impromptu audit, Siddiqui thought, and fought the urge to drive her fist into the console in frustration. She tapped in a command and brought up the hollow feed of the data center, hoping to find Akari. But her brother wasn't there. Where was he? Outside the medbay, the sound of blasters filled the audio track, distorting through the droid's aural pickups. And for the first time, Siddiqui Blur realized that she was in real trouble. XIX. In my time of dying. The power in the medbay was already out, and a cloak of darkness prevailed over its unfamiliar interior, save for the ambient glow of the diagnostic equipment, which cast a spectral blue glow on the figures moving through it, single file.
"Hold it,"
Voistok whispered, raising his hand without looking back.
"That's far enough."
Artigan glanced at him. He and Iagan were halfway across the medbay, creeping their way forward in almost total blackness. "How long can you keep the main power out?"
"Leave that to me,"
the guard said.
"I'll bring the droid around and take care of the programming to deactivate the charges."
Something shifted in the middle distance, and Artigan stiffened, glancing around. "Is there someone else in here with us?"
"No."
Voistok shook his head.
"I sealed the medbay up behind us. You saw me do it."
"I heard something."
"Shut up and stay put," the guard said. "Don't move, and don't touch anything."
He ducked his head and vanished.
"Father!"
Egan murmured a moment later.
"You know we can't trust him. Why would you? He's the only one who can help us. We need him. What if it's a trap?"
The boy whispered, his voice going higher with urgency.
"Better listen to your old man, kid," said Voistok. "I'm the only chance you've got."
As if on cue, Artigan sensed something sailing past him in the blackness. Grabbing his son's arm, he ducked and felt it graze his shoulder. As the thing turreted around, he saw the GH7's photoreceptors blink to life in the darkness, two perfect blue disks hovering before them. Artigan listened and heard it again, the sound of someone else in the medbay with them, closer now.
"Voistok,"
he hissed, turning in the direction of the sound.
"Is that you?"
No one answered. In front of them, barely visible, Artigan saw the droid moving closer, its manipulator extending a long, hypodermic needle.
"Father?"
the boy asked.
"It's all right,"
Artigan said.
"It will only hurt for a second. Then the charges will be deactivated. Go ahead."
"But..."
Egan started to say something, and the needle plunged through his prison uniform and directly into his upper thorax. The boy let out a sharp squawk of pain, but his words were lost beneath the sudden volley of blaster fire from outside the medbay. Artigan heard voices, guards shouting at one another, and the shooting started again.
"What?"
Glancing around, Artigan Truax saw the GH7 withdraw the needle from his son's chest, pivot in the air, and go flying backward.
"What is this? What's going on?"
5 meters away, Voistok stood up, rising to his full height.
"What's it sound like?"
He turned around and faced the two inmates. Outside, the blasters had stopped firing again, and Artigan heard a muffled voice barking orders, demanding whoever was inside to open up in there.
"You promised we'd have 15 minutes,
Artigan said.
"I gave you the Kipu! I gave you everything I had!"
"What? This?"
Voistok held up the string with the knots in it and threw it in Artigan's direction.
"Come on. You really think Radik would let you out of here that easily? After what you know about him?"
"Father."
Egan stared at his father.
"What's he talking about?"
"What, he never told you?
Voistock asked. He was grinning now.
Go ahead, old man. Tell your son why you're really here. Tell him how you brought him to this place.
You don't know what you're talking about,
Egan said.
Kid, I've heard just about enough from you.
Without taking his eyes off Artigan, Voistock jerked his right arm back and drove his elbow into the boy's face. Egan's head snapped sideways and he went flying into a tray of sterilized medical instruments, vascular clamps, and orthopedic drills, knocking them to the floor with a resonating crash of surgical steel. He lay there motionless.
Egan!
Artigan shouted, leaping up, then rounding on Voistock with a savage glare.
You'll pay for that. Easy, old man,
Voistock said, his hand sliding down to the detonator console on his belt.
Nobody's paying for anything just now. That whelp of yours just signed his death warrant. And by the gods, you're going to watch him redeem it.
Artigan lunged at Voistock and fell on him, ripping away the guard's belt, fighting with a ferocity that was ultimately pointless. Within a span of seconds, Voistock had rolled free and hammered Artigan twice in the stomach and once across the bridge of the nose before smashing his skull with the butt of his blaster over and over.
Maybe next time you listen when somebody tries to teach you some carking respect.
Voistock's hand went down to the detonator console, but it was gone. Artigan groaned. With monumental effort, he managed to lift his head. His face and scalp were bleeding profusely from a half-dozen different lacerations, but beneath it all, something vital and defiant still shone in his eyes.
Looking for this?
Artigan was breathing heavily, barely moving air. In his right hand, he held the drop box that he'd ripped from the guard's belt. He no longer looked steady on his feet, but his entire countenance was blazing with a kind of desperate willfulness, a stark and uncompromising refusal to go down.
Come on and take it. I don't need that thing anyway!
Voistock snarled, smearing blood from his own nose and raising the blaster.
Not when I've got this.
But Radik said...
Radik's only instruction was not to let you escape.
Voistock pointed the blade.